Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The city of Sacramento is cautiously celebrating a step in progress when it comes to curbing crime. This week, Sacramento police announced that as of this year, there's been a roughly 18% drop in violent crime within the city when compared to the same time period last year. And that's an overall percentage. According to the data, the drops are higher in rape cases and homicides, both reporting a 40% decrease compared to last year. But these numbers, while promising, are just a snapshot. Cap Radio reporter Kate Wolf joins us with a better understanding of the recent violent crime data within the city of Sacramento. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Vicky.
So this time period is through September of this year, and the roughly 18% drop in violent crime reported by Sac Police is an overall average. So how does it break up?
Okay, so there's a lot of numbers here. So robberies are down 6%. Aggravated assault cases are down 21%. Our rape cases are down 40%, and homicides are down 40% compared with the same time frame as last year. So that's January to September of 2022 versus January to September of 2023. And when I asked why that 9-month time frame at a press conference yesterday, they said it's because we've gotten through the summer months. So the summer months are the highest number, you know, where the highest number of crimes occur.
And so that's a 10-month stretch, 2022 compared to 2023. And we're having this conversation, or the city is also releasing this data because, you know, this comes on the heels of violent crime. It's been an issue in many cities across the country, including Sacramento, in recent years, specifically following, you know, COVID and the pandemic. So remind us what the past couple of years have been like within the city of Sacramento.
So the pandemic years in general across the nation, we saw an increase in violent crime, in homicides, assaults, other violent crime. Property crime actually decreased across the nation, but this was a nationwide trend, right? And there's not really very clear information about why we saw this increase in violent crime, although people have pointed to an increase in unemployment, in stress, in uncertainty. So in Sacramento specifically, we saw more than 50 murders in each of the past 2 years. And it was the first time that we reached that number since 2005, 2006. And that included a mass shooting that killed 6 people and left 12 people wounded on K Street in April of 2022. So last year had the most violent crime since 2008. So it was really significant.
Yeah, and that's probably why they're releasing these preliminary findings this week, because it is significant progress from what we've been going through collectively as a city for the last 2 years. So the police chief, Kathy Lester, shared the findings in front of the city council earlier this week. What is she saying that is contributing to this drop?
Right. So the chief really attributed this to a strategic approach, understanding that most urban violence occurs in very small geographic areas by a very small number of offenders. It's really concentrated. And last year, the Sacramento Police Department had this announced a violent crime reduction strategy, and they brought the Office of Violence Prevention under the Sheriff's Department. And that was a bit of a controversial move, which I'm sure I'll talk about later. But and they also got a grant from the U.S. Department of Justice to be a public safety partnership location. So they really have kind of done a targeted approach to addressing these pockets of real risk in the community.
Yeah, and I remember the chief said that Sacramento was just one of 6 cities that were selected by the DOJ. So, and using that as, you know, as really kind of like the right ingredients that are contributing to this preliminary findings of a drop in crime. So this data, though, although promising, is a snapshot. There's limitations always with data. So what doesn't it show?
Right. So something that Daryl Steinberg said is these are real people who are experiencing, you know, all these different factors. And also that not all crime is reported, right? So it's important to note that some people don't go to the police with crimes, especially when they feel that the police are not going to help them. They haven't been useful for them in the past, when maybe they feel that they have committed crime and they don't feel that they'll be safe in reporting that crime. You know, I will say that the city is bringing forward this crime data because they want to have positive headlines. They want to, you know, have a celebration of this information. And I think, you know, whether or not people, you know, support and celebrate that is up to them.
Yeah. And the mayor actually did talk about that in the city council meeting, saying that, you know, having positive headlines because of this data. The city council, you know, when they got these findings, they also approved, and this is earlier this week on Tuesday, $3.2 million in funding for community-based organizations. These are grassroots organizations that are focused on violence prevention. So what does that look like?
Right. So the work of these community-based organizations has played a critical role in reducing violent crimes, according to Chief Lester. And, you know, it looks like specific money given to these groups. Some of them are Academics for Athletes, Brother to Brother Mentoring, Hawk Institute, Impact SAC. I mean, these are groups, and they're getting kind of each of those groups got $225,000 this year. And what they're doing is really providing mentoring, life skills training, a place for people to go and feel safe, feel cared for. The city has a gang prevention and intervention task force, and you know, this is a bit of alphabet soup: evidence-based community violence interruption, disruption, suppression programs. And they've engaged hundreds of youth and delivered, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours of program services, including, you know, when the Sacramento Police Department gives them a call and says, hey, you know, we've got some kids who might need some intervention here. Can you come out and help?
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to some of these organizations. I mean, often they're on call like 24/7. So when things happen overnight at like 2 o'clock in the morning, they show up and they help reduce any tension that's happening. So overall, Kate, I mean, does this signal a shift? I mean, we're talking about Sacramento being selected among like six cities in the country from the DOJ. Now there's this grant funding that's going towards community-based organizations. Is this ultimately like a shift in a culture change in how community organizations and the city, they work together in tandem?
So I think that when the Office of Violence Prevention came under the Sacramento Police Department, there was a lot of backlash, right? Because of the George Floyd protests in 2020 and just a growing awareness of how racist and unjust the police system can be and our justice system can be, there's a lot of hesitancy about these community-based organizations working with the police. And so there were a number of community-based organizations who said, no, we don't want to be part of this program. We don't want to take your money because it's going to hurt our mission of the work that we're trying to do. But I think that these numbers show that, you know, when you're putting money into community-based organizations, the groups that did choose to work with the Sacramento Police Department, at least this is, you know, what the city, the message the city is trying to convey to us, that you know, it pays off in dividends. You know, I think it's a real, really strong investment in the community when these two groups work together. And I think I think it could signal a culture change in how these two work together.
Kate, thank you so much for helping us better understand the data.
Thank you, Vicky.
That is CAP Radio reporter Kate Wolf joining us with a better understanding of the recent violent crime data in the city of Sacramento. The police department is reporting a roughly 18% drop overall in violent crime when compared to the same time period last year. Up next, as we wake up to another mass shooting in America, we'll sit down with a man who lost his 5-year-old daughter to a school shooting in Scotland back in 1996 and learn what he thinks needs to be done to break our country's epidemic on gun violence. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When we booked our next guest to discuss the epidemic on gun violence in America, we had no idea what was to come. A mass shooting last night in Maine in two locations has killed at least 18 people, with dozens more injured. And that was confirmed this morning by Maine's governor, adding that authorities are still searching for the 40-year-old man who is considered a person of interest. This happened in the community of Lewiston, which is about 45 minutes north of Portland, Maine. And this latest mass shooting will sadly push the number of deaths in the United States this year even further. As of this morning, the tracking website Gun Violence Archive, which collects and verifies data daily from more than 7,000 sources across the country, reports that there have been 565 mass shootings so far this year, and that is defined as having a minimum of four victims shot, either injured or killed. Joining us today is Dr. Mike North, or Mick, as he prefers to be called. Dr. North lost his five-year-old daughter, Sophie, in a 1996 mass shooting at a school in Dublin, Scotland, in which 16 students and a teacher were killed, in addition to others who were injured. In the decades since, Dr. North has been dedicated to preventing mass shootings in the UK and has views on what could be done differently here at home. Mick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me. Yeah,
given the circumstances, and you have personally gone through this, you know, what are your immediate thoughts waking up and learning about what happened in Maine yesterday?
I'm shocked, as everyone will be, but then I'm not surprised. And I've been saying that for so many times over the last 20, 25 years since we went through the trauma of our loved ones being killed in a mass shooting. It's just happening far too often in the United States of America.
Yeah, and the fact that, I mean, you and your community endured this more than 20 years ago in 1996, and here we are again in 2023 talking about this. When you think of the community in Lewiston, Maine, what they are grappling with today in the aftermath of what happened, can you give us a glimpse of what you think they're going through right now?
Well, they're going through an awful experience at the moment because the perpetrator has not been caught. He's still out there. And I think it just shows you how awful the fear and dread that someone being armed with a firearm can cause. And that's one person and one firearm. And, of course, you have so many firearms and so many people who seem to be willing to misuse them in your country.
If we could go back to March of 1996 at the elementary school in Dublin, Scotland, can you tell us what happened?
My daughter was in her first year at the school. She was 5 years old, and she and her classmates were in the gymnasium of the school when a man burst in, shot dead 16 of the children, shot dead the teacher, seriously injured a number of the other children, and to other teachers before he killed himself. He was a man who had a grudge against the community, and he was also a legal gun owner, so he'd been allowed to own four handguns perfectly lawfully, along with hundreds of rounds of ammunition at home. So he could plan this and in the context of being a legal gun owner.
Prior to that day when you lost your daughter, Sophie, what was your view on firearms and the role that guns can play in society?
I didn't have particular views on guns. I didn't like them. I remember there were a number of times when I would turn the TV off, and Sophie and I decided we wouldn't watch something. I mean, Sophie was my only child. Her mum had died a few years earlier. So it was she and I, we were a team together. And, you know, sometimes it would be a joint decision. We don't like this, it has guns. But my thoughts on guns didn't really extend beyond that.
I would imagine that, I mean, your life has been irreparably changed, but it also made a pivotal change in your career path. What drives you every day after what happened?
It was a gradual process of getting into campaigning, and I think that was the same for the other families. We became a very close-knit group, partly to support one another, but gradually with the realization that we all wanted something to be done to make sure this didn't happen again. And we all came to the same decision that the way to deal with this was to eliminate the weapon that this man had been able to use, which this man had been able to get hold of so easily under the current legislation.
You know, given that you and 15 or 16 other families you have this shared life experience that is incredibly tragic and painful and traumatic. When you see coverage of mass shootings that take place, is there something that's missing from the conversation? I mean, I know today, following Maine, there's going to be a lot of coverage in the days and weeks to come, but are you satisfied with how they are covered?
Not from the way I perceive it from the other side of the pond. There's a lot of thoughts and prayers, and I know it's been said by a lot of commentators in your own country that that everyone has thoughts and prayers, but for a lot of people, and sadly amongst your politicians, it rarely seems to go beyond that. And you can't cure this, you can't sort out this problem with a brief period of thoughts and prayers. What we decided was that bold action was necessary, that you really had to have fewer guns. Fewer guns would mean fewer violence. International gun comparisons show that the lower the level of gun ownership in a country, the lower the level of gun violence. And that is crystal clear. And America is out there with very high gun ownership and very high gun violence, and they are correlated.
I mean, given that you and other families transformed your grief into action, you know, what did you do in the years since to prevent other mass shootings like the one that happened at Dublin Primary School?
Once we had achieved the aim of getting handguns completely banned, something that happened in two stages, but happened very quickly over a two-year period. Private ownership of handguns was prohibited within 2 years of Dunblane happening. But one of the things that I was involved in, as well as campaigning for a handgun ban, was the setting up of a new organisation, the Gun Control Network. There had been no gun control organisation in Britain until the shootings had happened. But we set up this organisation with a view not only to push for a handgun ban, but also to be there in the long term to argue the case for public safety always taking priority over the wishes of the gun lobby. And we're still around. We are still pushing the government to make changes to gun legislation whenever we feel public safety is being compromised. And during those first years, one of the main things we had to make sure of, that there was no backtracking, that we knew the gun lobby would attempt to get their handguns back, and they did that. They tried to persuade the government that because they couldn't compete in the same way in the Olympic Games, that they should be allowed to have their guns back. But we managed to make sure there was no backtracking. And you have to be vigilant because you're up against a very powerful vested interest, and one that in many ways is prepared to stop at nothing to get what they want.
I mean, the fact that you were able to harness the political will in just 2 years following what happened at your daughter's school. I mean, that is like light speed compared to, you know, relatively when we look here in our country. I mean, I go back to Columbine High School, the school shooting. That was in 1999. Mm-hmm. You know, that was around the same time of what happened in Scotland. And here we are, 2023. There are more than one mass shooting a day so far this year in the United States. Why do you think the political will in Scotland allowed for this to happen in such a short period of time for you and other families that wanted these changes?
I mean, I don't know. I wish your politicians would be bolder, stop being frightened of confronting the gun lobby and actually look at the evidence, look at what was achieved, not just in Great Britain, but in other Western industrialized nations. And look at the evidence that where there are fewer guns, there's fewer gun violence. Just to give a few figures for your listeners, over the last 12 months in London, a city of 9 million people, there have been just 7 fatal shootings. In Great Britain as a whole, there have just been 25 gun homicides in the last 12 months. That compares with a figure over 100 times higher in the United States, over 40 times higher, I believe, in California. And what's the difference? The difference is we have very many fewer guns. And in relation to what we achieved at Dunblane, we have very many fewer handguns. And handguns are the weapon that is mostly used in gun violence. I know there's a lot of talk about assault weapons. And I think it's important that assault weapons are off the streets of America, that everything is possible to take them out. But you have to do something about handguns as well, because they are responsible for the majority of gun deaths in the United States.
So as it stands now, today in Great Britain, who can and cannot have a firearm?
Nobody can have a handgun. Private ownership of handguns is banned. Self-loading rifles and shotguns had previously been prohibited after an earlier gun massacre in a town called Hungerford in England. So that would include some of the things that are being described as assault weapons here. But it is still possible to own and use shotguns and rifles for deer stalking, shooting game birds, clay pigeon shooting. You have to apply for a license. You have to go through quite a stringent process, although we are trying to get that process tightened up. So it is still possible to own those types of gun, but only not multi-shot rapid-firing weapons.
And I would imagine law enforcement there can have firearms?
Routinely, police officers are not armed in Britain. And I think that'll stay that way. And I think the fact that there is a handgun ban has certainly helped in that. There are special firearms units, specially trained, and they're deployed to serious incidents and to sensitive areas. But routinely, individual police officers are not armed. And that, too, makes Britain feel like a safer place.
Given that there's been a significant reduction in gun-related deaths in Great Britain in the decades following the school shooting in Dublin, Scotland, was it just changing laws to who can have access to firearms, or is there a mental health component as well? Because mental health often gets tied with gun violence and mass shootings.
I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, but to my mind, you can't pin the difference between our two countries on mental health. It would mean you have to have a mental health problem that is 100 times worse than Britain. That is impossible. That's unimaginable. It is not mental health. The problem is the ease with which people, whether they have mental health problems or not, can get hold of firearms.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Mike McNorth. He helped lead a successful campaign to completely ban civilian ownership of handguns in Great Britain following the 1996 mass shooting at a school in Dublin, Scotland, where his then 5-year-old daughter, Sophie, was killed. When it comes to the United States, and you've touched upon this, our country overwhelmingly leads in mass shootings of any developed country in the world. The United States is home to nearly half of the world's civilian-owned guns, and both are from data from last year. You know, there is a culture of gun ownership in the United States, in addition to the Second Amendment. It's part of the Constitution. You know, do you think, how does that shape the possibility of adopting legislation that could help reduce gun violence and mass shootings? Is it, can you just take what happened in Great Britain and apply it to the United States? I would say no.
But ultimately, there should be no reason not to. Surely our values are the same. We value the lives of our children. We value our own lives. And you can't just accept the situation as it is. I mean, I think I heard one of your reports earlier on talking about the shootings in Maine, saying, oh, this is the world we live in. And there has to be hope that we avoid these situations. There must be more hope than this. As far as the Second Amendment is concerned, yeah, I mean, you have this ridiculous Heller decision, which has codified into the US Constitution a broad right that the Second Amendment codifies into the US Constitution a broad right to private gun ownership that your country's founders inherited from the English Declaration of Rights from 1689. After Dunblane, when we were arguing that handguns should ban, British gun owners said nothing about this Declaration of Rights. As far as they were concerned, it didn't confer them any broad right to gun ownership. So you have a Supreme Court decision that is dependent on something that is actually preposterous. There should be no reason why you have to continue and can't find a way. Americans should be smart enough to find a way to reduce gun violence by looking to ban as many weapons as possible, including handguns.
But given that currently we have almost half of the world's civilian-owned guns in this country, and that's not even talking about ghost guns, which are not traceable, how would you even be able to, let's get to hypothetically, if this actually moved forward, how would you even be able to enforce a law when there's already a number of guns already here in the country?
It's just going to be very difficult. I'm not going to pretend it's easy. But I think you have to look at what you want to achieve. You can't, or it feels to me that you can't go on having these thoughts and prayers so frequently, and yet the situation gets worse and worse. Someone has got to tackle this head on and start adopting and advocating bold policies. I haven't got a magic solution of how you do this, but you've got to start working towards it. Otherwise, it feels to me that it's just going to get worse and worse.
And this differs from one state to another in the United States. Mm-hmm. This is far from a consensus. California has some of the toughest gun control measures in the country, but we are still home to gun violence. We are still home to mass shootings. One in which I covered, the person who committed this mass shooting just went across state lines. You know, you're not supposed to do that, but got a firearm, brought it over to California, and committed a mass shooting. And this was in Gilroy. So, in your view, looking at the dynamics of the United States. You know, California has some of the toughest gun control measures, but these are new, unique, nuanced issues. How do you solve them?
Well, again, I mean, I would hope that Americans are, with the will and the commitment, I would hope that Americans are smart enough to be able to find a way to do it. Yes, there were, Britain doesn't have some of these complications, But at least what happened showed that the British public and the campaigners and, in the end, British politicians were willing to take the bold measures that were necessary.
Do you think the political climate today is the same as when it was in 1996, when you and other families were able to garner that political will? Because there have been multiple attempts over the years in the United States to have bipartisan legislation, you know, quote unquote, common sense, you know, gun laws. I think following Newtown, the shooting, it didn't happen. Do you think the political climate today is the same as it was when you and other families were able to achieve this?
I think in the US it's got worse. I think I came here a couple of times in the late 1990s. There seemed to be more optimism that things could change, particularly after Columbine, but then nothing happened. And it seems to have gone backwards since then, unfortunately. I think the gun violence figures show that there's been an increase over the last 20 years or so. In Britain, another consequence of what was achieved after Dunblane was the atmosphere in which gun issues were discussed. The time of the Dunblane school shooting, it was the gun lobby who were largely listened to, sometimes almost exclusively, by the lawmakers. But since then, Gun Control Network, the organisation that I helped set up, is now routinely asked its opinion. We're listened to. There's not always a positive response to what we're asking for, but we are part of the discussion now. So there is a greater balance with the views that are being heard by the lawmakers in Britain these days.
When I have talked to people who advocate for having firearms sensible and legal access to firearms, I think of some district attorneys and sheriffs that I've spoken to, you know, there is an argument made that most law-abiding, responsible gun owners are not the ones who are carrying out gun violence or mass shootings. Is that a legitimate argument?
No, because... It would certainly be true that most gun owners aren't going to break the law, but there are a lot of people who get their guns legally, who do break the law, who are responsible for mass shooting. The majority of mass shootings in Britain and elsewhere are carried out by people who have obtained their guns legally. And this is something that I feel the gun lobby is never prepared to acknowledge. This idea that gun owners are the most law-abiding people. This includes people who have committed mass shootings. So that is the reality, that people who can get their guns perfectly legally, perfectly easily, some of them, I'm not saying all of them, but some of them do commit horrendous unlawful acts. Mm.
As we close on the last few minutes of our conversation, you know, you lost your daughter 27 years ago. When you reflect on that time, how have you changed as a person since that day in March of 1996 to today?
I don't know. I think that's for others to judge. I hope it hasn't changed me too much. Obviously, I used to be an academic. I used to be teach biochemistry and microbiology. I haven't done that for a long time. I've been doing something else. And I don't want guns and advocating for gun control to dominate my life. I want there to be other things. But clearly, I have been doing things I wouldn't have thought about doing and would never have done had my daughter not been killed that day.
Given that, there's going to be a lot of conversations and thoughts about this latest mass shooting in Maine in the days and weeks to come. How do you want people to talk about it? What do you hope these conversations are like?
I want it to be at the top of people's priorities, that this shouldn't be something that is important to them for a few days after the latest mass shooting. It should be something that is prioritized throughout the year throughout the years until things are changed.
Yeah, and I have to actually acknowledge the reason why you're here in Sacramento. You spoke to UC Davis Medical School students earlier this week. What brought you to Sacramento and how were those conversations?
Well, I came here the invitation of Americans Against Gun Violence. They're the only organization in the U.S. that advocates the kind of dramatic change in gun law that we had in Great Britain, including advocating a ban on handguns. And I want to speak to people in America to remind them of what happened at Dunblane, but then, in some ways, more importantly, what the response to Dunblane was, and that we could change things. The people of Britain wanted a change. We could channel those views, we could talk to the politicians, and we could get the politicians to change their minds. You do need politicians, and I hope some will come who will look for bold changes. All I can do is say that what we managed to do in Britain has led to to low levels of gun violence, which have been maintained ever since.
Mick, thank you so much for the time.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Michael North is the author of a book called Dunblane, Never Forget, where he recounts losing his 5-year-old daughter, Sophie, in the 1996 mass shooting at an elementary school in Dublin, Scotland. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Latinos have long been a growing force in California and beyond. For nearly a decade, it's taken the top spot as the largest racial or ethnic group in the state, currently making up roughly 40% of California's population. And nationally, Latinos or Hispanics in the official census data have long been among or the fastest growing demographic. Behind these numbers are a great deal of influence and spending power. Visit Sacramento is the bureau tasked with attracting tourism to the city and the county, and they are seizing an opportunity to expand how they reach hundreds of millions of Latinos around the world with a Spanish language podcast. It's called Bienvenidos a Sacramento, and it highlights the vibrant spirit, achievements, and contributions of the Latinos behind local businesses. So joining us today are the podcast hosts, Lily Cortez Wyatt and Sonia Bradley, who leads the diversity, equity, and inclusion arm at Visit Sacramento. Lily and Sonia, welcome. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I want to start off with a little background of the both of you. I would love to start with your connections to Sacramento. Lily?
Great. Well, Sacramento is now my home. I moved here 20 years ago when I was a news producer, news reporter, spent about 17 years of my life in the news broadcast world, moved here during the recall election and have called Sacramento home since then. I am a communicator, so I've had my business, my public relations and marketing agency, Socios PR, for the last 7 years. And luckily, Sonia and the team at Visit Sacramento have, you know, engaged us to help reach and communicate and really make or help our Hispanic audience engage with Visit Sac.
And the recall of Governor Gray Davis, correct?
Correct.
Yes, that election.
Thank
yes.
you.
How about you, Sonia? What are your ties to Sacramento?
Hi. I'm just 1 year ahead of Lily. I've been here about 21 years, moved from the Bay Area to actually work with Visit Sacramento. We were the Sacramento Convention and Visitors Bureau back then. And I started off, always been in marketing and communications. So been with them through a lot of changes in the city, which has been great. And I definitely consider Sacramento home. And within the last several years, I took on the role of diversity, equity, and inclusion, where, yes, as Lily said, we got together and then started to work on some projects together.
What does DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, what does that look like when you're working with Visit Sacramento, which is working to attract tourism and visitors to the city?
Yeah, when we took this on, you know, we really looked at the entire spectrum of what's happening in the tourism world, and we sort of boiled it down to three pillars. We looked at our programs and practices, we looked at community engagement, and we looked at education and skill development. Most people know us by our programs and practices, from the Farm to Fork Festival to all the events that we produce, and DEI, part of that was looking at it really through a clearer lens to see that how are we being equitable in who we attract to our events? Is it diverse in terms of attendees as well as vendor participation? And that's been a big part of what we've been doing in terms around DEI. And community engagement is very much aligned with that as well. And that's kind of how Lily and I started talking about, you know, what are the neighborhoods that we're missing in terms of what we're doing around DEI?
Yeah, I mean, Sacramento, I mean, the greater Sacramento area is incredibly diverse. So I would imagine, Sonia, it was easy for you to find, you know, local vendors, you know, that reflect the diversity of our community.
Oh, absolutely. And what I've loved and been fortunate to do is I've been visiting so many different neighborhoods, and I am proud to say I've ate my way through a lot of them. So from Little Saigon to the Northgate area, Franklin Boulevard, those are some of the areas that I've been to. And the depth of generations of people who've been here doing amazing things. It would be awesome to share that with visitors.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I completely agree. I always take people on a food tour when they come to visit Sacramento, especially if they've never been. So how did the podcast come about, a Spanish language podcast?
Well, I'll just give the background and I'll let Lily take it from there. Essentially, we started about a year ago to really develop our Spanish language content. And honestly, we started with like one page of a website. And we've been working with Socios PR since the beginning of this for Lily's expertise just in communication and broadcasting, but also she's very fluent and her staff is fluent in Spanish as well. And that's how we got started. And we just kept looking at what other platforms could we disseminate our information, communication, and really just share the beauty of the Latino heritage that's here in Sacramento. And the podcast was an idea. I think, Lily, you kind of brought it to us because we do have an English language podcast that we've been doing for several years. And we wanted to add on to some of the things that we offer. And Lily, take it from there.
Well, first of all, I do want to just give credit to Visit Sacramento, because so many businesses decide to just have a toggle on their websites that say translate, you know, to any other language.
And that doesn't always work out so well.
No, not very well, because Google Translate does not make it conversational. It just does its job, which is translation. But Visit Sacramento took it a step further and decided to engage us to really adapt and make the content conversational and unique, and apply it to the way that that our Spanish speakers read and understand the content to make it engaging. So that was a great plus for Visit Sacramento. And really, when we saw the popularity of the Visit Sacramento podcast hosted by Brandon, it was during Hispanic Heritage Month last year that we said, you know, why don't we actually have a podcast in Spanish? And why? It's because of the popularity of podcasts. And you probably know, I think that you've discussed this on Inside before, that podcast is booming. According to the Edison research, 42% of Americans ages 12 and older have listened to a podcast in the past month. The same research company said that 59% of U.S. Latinos ages 18 and over have ever listened to a podcast. Now, 66% of U.S. Latinos listen to podcasts in Spanish. So that's where we saw the opportunity. It's huge because we are listening to podcasts in our language, and when they are hosted by a Latino, Latina host or somebody that speaks the language and can actually have a conversation, they are more engaged in the content and they will subscribe and they will become your fans, basically.
And I can see why you're a great fit for this because, you know, since you left news and you started a PR firm, I mean, as Sonia mentioned, like your entire staff, they're bilingual, they speak Spanish. And I would imagine that that was an untapped market. So you have these deep connections with the local business community, with which is people who live here. So when you were thinking about what Bienvenidos a Sacramento, the Spanish language podcast, what it would look like, what did you want it to look like? What did you want it to sound like?
Oh, my God. There is, first of all, Sacramento, really, the history is founded in Latinos, Hispanics. I mean, this was part of Mexico. You know, it's part of the history. But also so many people just like me who are fully bilingual, who are bicultural, have made Sacramento home. So I wanted to share, you know, the anecdotes, the curiosities, the livelihoods of people that have established businesses here, but also why people should visit Sacramento. We're talking about 600 million Spanish speakers around the world. That is an untapped market for Sacramento visitor other bureaus of tourism. So we really want to let people know that Sacramento is a place to visit. We have so much variety. There's so much entertainment. There's art. There's the river. Within the city, there's just so much to discover and to meet the people that make Sacramento great. So,
you profile like the people behind businesses?
Yes, we profile the people behind the businesses. So during the Hispanic Heritage Month, which was a kickoff series last month, we highlighted six of these just fascinating Latinos that are trailblazers in the area. And just hearing their stories and hearing why they made Sacramento home, where they go when they have people visiting from Colombia, from Mexico, from Nicaragua, where do they take their visitors? And everybody takes them to the river. You know, Old Sac, obviously beautiful, but also our trails where they can just walk and explore nature. Again, we are one of the best cities for food. We were just recognized as the top 10 foodie city in the country. So people don't know that. And, you know, 20 years ago when I moved here, it was just basically a stop and a hop to Tahoe. Now people are coming and staying and visiting Sacramento. So we want to encourage people from around the world to don't just come here and just drive by Sacramento, stop by Sacramento.
Exactly. Right. I mean, even friends who came to visit, you know, they never really thought about visiting Sacramento. But then when I show them around, they're like, oh, wow, like I had no idea that Sacramento was like this.
We get that all the time, all the time.
And that's why this podcast, right, in two languages is very important. You know, what have been some of the most memorable moments of you did six episodes. I mean, what have been some of your favorite parts?
Oh, my God. Just getting to know them and having conversations in Spanish, because when I really talk to them, and this six individuals I've known because of my business and the work that I've done in Sacramento, but I've always talked to them in English. So being able to talk to them in Spanish, it was just a different kind of experience. It was just like feeling like we're at home and we're talking in our language and sharing with the people around the world what makes them unique, what makes Sacramento unique. For example, you know, some of the people that we had on the episodes were Dinora with Mariachi Bonitas, who
we've had her a couple times on the show.
Yes,
she's wonderful.
Amazing. And the way that she just describes everything about her trajectory as a musician was just fascinating. I loved having Alex Rodrigo on the show, who is the first Latino to lead an NBA team. He's in Sacramento. So we wanted to highlight people that are really making an impact.
That's wonderful. So what has the feedback and the response been?
Everything that I've heard anecdotally has been very positive. Like Lily said, we're here, you know, our first foremost goal is always to attract visitors to Sacramento. So being able to spread that message, we've gotten good feedback. Downloads are coming in, and nicely that it's evergreen. It will live on forever, and it will be always part of our promotion. It's not just the podcast that we do in Spanish. We are doing promotion in Spanish as well. So it's a really holistic way of reaching out to the Spanish-speaking audience because, like she said, there's, you know, 600 million speakers. It's, I think it's the dominant language in about 20 countries. So being able to attract that and knowing also that even Mexico, like she said, with, you know, the Sacramento Hispanic Chamber said, you know, 81% of Hispanics live in our region are of Mexican heritage. So we know that friends or families are a huge number of visitors to our area. So being able to share that with people coming in. But overall, it's been a really positive experience. And we've actually had several of those people on, you know, the Visit Sacramento podcast as well.
That's wonderful. Well, Lily and Sonia, thank you for having the idea. And it's sticking. And hopefully it builds more momentum in the months and years to come. Thank you
That's
for joining
what we
us.
Hope. Thank you so much. Please listen to Bienvenidos a Sacramento.
Yes. And we do have a link on our Insight page as well. That is Sonia Bradley, the Chief of Diversity, Equity, Inclusion at Visit Sacramento. And Lily Cortez Wyatt is the host of the new podcast, Bienvenidos a Sacramento, for Visit Sacramento. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to shoot us an email, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Suri Lyshinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll catch you back here on Monday, not tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.